Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 162. Look at that. We're flying through them, aren't we? Thank you for tuning in, guys. How are you? You can't answer that because you're listening to me. And I've recorded this like a week ago anyway. So ignore that. Ignore the how are you, and let's focus on today's podcast. In fact, I'm going to tell you loads of things before we get to today's podcast. Today's podcast is with Alice Lowe, who's fantastic. And I was very, very excited to have on. I did a thing a while ago asking for people to recommend guests, and Alice Lowe was one of the people that was recommended. And I'm a big fan of Alice. I loved her in Garth Marenghi, Dark Place, in Sightseers, and in Prevenge, which we talk about a lot because that's what had just come out when we recorded this a couple of weeks ago. It's also worth a mention that she's got a new film out called The Ghoul with Tom Meaton and directed by Gareth Tunley. I recommend you go and check that. She didn't have that out when we talked about it, like when we met up to talk, so it's not really plugged, but it comes out in cinemas in the UK on what day is it? On Friday, on August 4th. It's produced by Ben Wheatley, who I want to get on the podcast because he's amazing. So this podcast is out today. It's my birthday tomorrow, August 3rd, and then The Ghoul is out on Friday, if anyone fancies that, so that's worth a look. Things I've got to tell you about. When last year, I released Distraction Pieces podcast, the book, and it became an Unexpected Times bestseller, and part of that was I did a Distraction Pieces tour, so I did live podcasts, and I think what's good about the Distraction Pieces podcast is its intimate conversation. So I don't think that would translate on stage. So the way I do the live ones, I did a live one in London last year and the year before, is you guys are the guests. So I'll kind of come out and chat for a minute or two. And then you kind of have to form an orderly queue, and you get to come on stage and ask a question or pick a topic for discussion, and we'll have a little chat. So rather than it just being passing a mic into the crowd or anything, you come up and we sit down and we have a discussion. And they've gone down really well in the past. But a thing that me and Dan Lissac always had when we toured, and a thing that I had on my solo tours, was we'd end every tour in Ireland, because a brief bit of history of me musically, a lot of you won't know, but when we started out touring, we went to Ireland, and at that point we learned that people only tended to go to Ireland and play Dublin, maybe Dublin and Belfast, but we went and played Cork and Limerick and all these other amazing places, and Galway, our home away from home, and Derry and everywhere. And it meant we always had this really good, feverish following in Ireland. So we always insisted on the tours that we ended in Ireland. Now, the book tour was a different thing, because I had to go essentially where the publishers told me to go. So we didn't make it to do the Distraction Pieces podcast in Ireland. So this year I decided I'm not going to do any live Distraction Pieces podcast. I know a few people will be hoping for a London announcement soon, because it's normally August, September, October, I do them, but I've no plans to do one, although I will be popping along to the Hardcore Listing podcast live on August 10th at the Hoxton Bar and Kitchen, and hopefully Tuesday Night Jaw live on September 9th at the London Podcast Festival. Anyway, yes, so I decided earlier in the year I'm not going to do any this year. I'm just swamped. I've got so many projects I'm working on. But then my good friend Leagues O'Toole, who's always booked me and Dan in Dublin and is just a top, top guy and a good friend, he emailed me saying, I'm doing a podcast festival in Dublin. Do you fancy coming and doing a Distraction Pieces? And I said, Leagues, mate, I've got so much on. I've got a few different potential acting gigs that would mean that if they came in, I couldn't do it. I really can't it's not a good idea. I sent that email and then I immediately sent another email saying, oh, go on in, let's do it. So we're doing it on Thursday, September 21st. I will be at the Tivoli Theatre. Tivoli. That sounds a lot more Irish. I'll be at the Tivoli Theatre in Dublin doing a live Distraction Pieces podcast. You can buy tickets now, as it's the first ever one over there. I'm really hoping it sells well and you guys swoop and come out, because it'll be great to see you all. Obviously, I'll be knocking about, like anyone who's come to any of my live shows knows, I'll be knocking about afterwards to sign stuff. I'll probably have a merch table. I'll sign stuff, have photos, do the whole meet and greet thing. That's free. That comes with the price of the ticket. So, yeah, hugely excited to announce that. The Distraction Pieces podcast live in Dublin on September 21st. And another announcement. I mean, I should mention that this feels like tons of plugs and adverts. The Distraction Pieces podcast, as ever, is brought to you by speechofelementrecords.com. We're coming to the end of the summer. I'd like to sell as much of our dark summer wear as we can. So we've got swimsuits, men and women. We've got sunglasses. The sunglasses, probably by the time this podcast comes out, might be sold out, but if not, swoop and get them. They've been the insane hit of the summer, and they've inspired me with my plans for our dark winter range, which will come soon. But yeah, head over there and check them out. But what a lot of you have been waiting for, again, this is a long intro, I'm sorry, guys. Last year, I teamed up with a trainer company called OHW, which is who backwards, OHW question mark. And I designed some trainers, and I was hugely excited because, man, getting to design a pair of trainers is insane. And unexpectedly, the limited run sold out in pre-order, so before they were even released. So we decided that we would do a full range. And the original run, we only did guys shoes. So on this run, we decided we'd do guys and girls, two designs for guys and two designs for girls. And I want to just quickly get in the fact that on the girls front, I refused to make them girly in any way, I'm afraid. The fact is, the original design had a lot of love from girls saying they'd love to have had them in girl sizes. So the new design for the girls is based hugely on the original design for guys, and the guys one is tweaked a little bit. But yeah, anyway, I'm going to be teasing information about that, but they're actually being released on Wednesday, August 30th. So I'm just giving you a heads up there. I haven't really got a lot of information. Keep an eye on my Instagram and I'll leak some stuff, because they've done some great photo shoots and they look amazing. But yeah, also Sage Francis and B Dolan are literally in the country now. They're in Scotland, but they're on this island. They're at the Edinburgh Fringe and they're doing their amazing Sage and B. Their show is going to be, it's going to be insane. It's spoken word with some musical and visual entertainment. It's called Tricknology, and it's going to be insane. Just take my word on this. Please go and see it. It's at the Edinburgh Fringe, the 4th until the 27th, Newtown Theatre, Lower Hall, 6:35 till 7:35, every day except Mondays. Also, Rob Alton's up there. He's up there every year, and every year I've gone to see a Rob Alton, and it's been either my favourite or one of my favourite shows. So go and check both those, or all three of those homies out. That's probably all I need to say. I'm rambling on tons. That's a loads of stuff. This was a really nice podcast. I was so pleased to be able to line it up and make it happen. Because, as I mentioned, I'm a big fan of Alice, and we arranged to meet in South London because she had a little bit of time spare, because she had someone looking after her new little baby. So again, I didn't want her to have to travel all the way into Central or out to Essex, so I went and met her in South London, and we had a lovely chat. So I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end with more information. See you in a bit.
Probably talked about a lot of the similar sort of things recently, so veering off is not a bad thing.
That's perfect.
I've been on a promotional tour of Prevenge for like 8 months.
How are they? Because particularly with the interesting things with films, I find, for actors, is that it's something that you... It's everything in your life for a certain amount of time, and then it's over, and then you're on to the next project.
Yeah.
And then when you're really deep into the next project... You have to go and be excited about the one that you finished a year or two ago.
Yeah.
So how is that on the promo runs of getting excited about it again?
I don't think I had a break, really, because the film was made pretty quickly and then came out pretty quickly in relation. And also I'd had a baby, so I wasn't working on anything else. I was just looking after the baby.
Yeah, and that's easy, you know. So.
Yeah, that's easy. But also, you know, it was my project, so I don't think I had that same jaded thing that, like, George Clooney might have. If, like, there was some film he didn't really like doing,
onto the
and
next
then
one
he's
kind
got
of thing.
To go and promote it around the world because it's in his contract. So I kind of, you know, I enjoyed it. I look back on it now and I go, my God, that was knackering doing all of that. But I didn't really know that at the time. It was only sort of afterwards that I went, oh, I was quite tired.
Yeah, that was exhausting. So I should add some context. I'm talking to Alice Lowe, and the film we're talking about at the moment is a Prevenge.
Prevenge. There's two schools of pronunciation, but I say Prevenge.
Yeah, I was pleased that just before we started rolling, you mentioned it, therefore I knew which way to say it. That was genuinely, I was thinking, is it Prevenge or Prevenge? But yeah. And obviously that is what you've been on a promo run for, so you probably are sick of talking about it, but it's a fascinating kind of story and there's a lot I want to know about it, so we will get on to other stuff too. I mentioned in our initial conversation, in my top five shows ever is Garth Marenghi, so I definitely, we're going to be going all over the place. But so Prevenge... You were pregnant when you were making it.
Yes.
And it's about someone being pregnant.
Yeah.
Did you get pregnant purely for the film? Yeah. Or was it an...
I found a sperm donor and I requested... No, I'm not
really
that method.
Really method.
I just wanted to sort of, you know, do one better than Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't get pregnant.
It's one that I found fascinating, though, because it's key to the script and the whole project... So was it an idea you already had and when you became pregnant it came to life, or was it something you wrote incredibly quickly and could get going whilst pregnant?
I was already pregnant and I was developing a film, but I kind of thought because I was pregnant that I wouldn't be able to make a film. I just was like, it's one or the other, have a baby or make a film while I'm having a baby. So I probably will never get to make a film. I actually thought that because I was like, who starts their directing career with a small child, know what I mean? And so I was like, oh, right, well, it's probably not going to happen. And then a company came to me and said, look, we've got private financing to make a film. We really like Sightseers, which I did a few years ago.
Yeah.
If you want to make a film with us, it could be whatever you like, whatever you want to write. And we can shoot it really quickly. And I was like, oh, why is this happening now? This is like exactly what I've been looking for to happen to me in the last sort of 3 or 4 years after making Sightseers. I was like, I thought people would be coming to me every week with these kinds of opportunities, but they weren't really. So, and I actually said no initially. I was like, I'm pregnant, because I was quite far along. I was like five to 6 months pregnant when they sort of made this offer. And then I kind of went away and had a little think about it and kind of went, oh, I actually should do this because I am quite worried about work. I don't, there's no guarantee I'll ever work again after having a baby. And so I went, I kind of had the, I've often thought, like, taxi driver, someone should do a female taxi driver.
Yeah.
So I'd often talked about that actually. And then I thought, what would I play as a pregnant character? So I was kind of like, well, if you put those two things together and you sort of get this sort of misanthropic kind of depressed character who's a loner but she's pregnant,
yeah,
and that would be a sort of female taxi driver. And then I've sort of pitched it to the company as a, you know, Prevenge. It's like a revenge movie, but with a pregnant woman. And they were like, we love it. I was like, can we do it in the next 2 months? And they were like, yes.
Amazing.
And before I knew it, we were doing it. And there was going to be, someone else was going to be directing it. Jeremy right. Adams was going to direct it. And then he was like, look, it's your story. I don't think I can tell this story.
I love it.
He makes rom-coms usually. And so then I was directing it as well.
Well, that's what I found amazing and fascinating about it is obviously it's a very, surreal, it's a very extreme, unusual story. It's not realism. It's this exaggerated thing. But it is also one of the most real portrayals because you generally don't get a portrayal of any kind of mental trauma or depression or fear of pregnancy in film. You generally get, oh, it's so glorious, I'm having a baby.
Or it's funny.
Look, or listen to my bump and all this kind of thing. And you don't have the kind of the worry, the fear, the anxiety, which is part of it as well and should be addressed. So again, I'm not obviously painting, you know, a massive murderous revenge movie as the as the justification or the balance of this, but it did strike me in that way that it was striking a blow for those who get pregnant and go, oh, it's not like I've seen in films or on TV.
Well, I mean, that was why I could write it so quickly, because I was in the middle of this experience. And for me, I was already worried about work and I was worried about psychologically what effect it was going to have on me. Was I going to enjoy it? Like, I'd always had so much freedom as a writer, a performer, whatever, in my job and in my life. I'd sort of pick and choose what I want to do. If I'm going to be without money, it's fine because it's just me.
Of course.
I won't eat for a few weeks or whatever. And suddenly I was like, oh, everything's going to change. And I was worried about it. So all of that stuff I put into this metaphor of this woman who's deeply unhappy and has lost a big part of her identity and she's going on to take revenge on society and stuff. And so it came really easily to me because I think I was psychologically in the middle of that. And for me, it was like I really wanted to tell the story from the inside. I think there are horror films that are about anxieties about pregnancy.
Yeah.
But they're usually from the outside in. I feel like they're kind of someone who's fears pregnancy in someone else.
And I was like,
I want this to be about a woman who's going through these experiences. And also, like, in a non-exclusive way, I sort of wanted men, whoever, people who haven't had kids, to be able to watch this and go, oh, that's how it might feel for me if I was pregnant. That it's as strange to the audience as it is this character, that she's providing this psychological weird exploration
Completely.
For the audience.
And that makes sense, because on the surface at the start, it feels like the horror character is the character that you're playing and the person that's going around killing. And as it goes on, you realise the horror character is really the child inside of your character, and your character's fear of that child is driving everything. So it's kind of, it's not as simple as it's a crazy pregnant lady. It kind of, the horror really comes, is, as you said, is all happening internally. As much as it's manifesting externally because people are getting killed and there's some horrific injuries. Poor old Tom Davis, who's been on the podcast as well, he has a rough end. But again, it was fascinating to see that the horror, it's really an internal horror story rather than the more obvious external horror story that drives the first level of narrative.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. I never wanted to... I mean, this is something that emerged, really. I don't know how much I really planned this, but... You know, I think that when you see a horror film, quite often it's sort of generally telling a story, like a fairy tale. And it's like, this could happen to anyone. And with this story, the more that I made it, the more I realised it was about this one woman, it's everything that's going on in her head, like the music, the sights, the sounds, everything is psychologically where she is. And it's quite a weird story.
Yeah.
And I think that was how we could bring together, as you said, like this mixture of realism and surrealism, because it's just everything that's happening to her. Is she mad? We don't know. Is she, you know, psychologically affected by what's happening to her? And as you say, it's a very, very internal thing, which I think enabled it for people to watch it and identify with it weirdly.
Yeah.
Rather than just going, oh, she's nothing to do with me, this woman. She's this horrible woman. Some people might watch it in that way and hate her and hate the film. But, you know, I was kind of like, she's peculiar. She's an oddity, this creature, this woman. But weirdly, I think that makes people identify more with her.
Yeah.
Because she's an outsider and she's completely strange. And
it's a fascinating one because it's finding... And it's what was done amazingly with Sightseers as well, that it's writing characters that are the villain, that are murderous, that are cold-blooded, but written in a really real and warm and genuine way. And again, that sounds like to write that you'd have to make it in some way unrealistic, but it's not. They're all done in very matter-of-fact ways, in Prevenge and in Sightseers. There's no kind of big switch moment as such. It's all just, okay, well, this is happening.
I think it's partly what comes from approaching writing or filmmaking as an actor as well. Oh. It's like, you know, you have to like the characters you play, even if they're baddies. You know, that's kind of, I think Dustin Hoffman says that. It's like you, when you're playing Hitler or, you know, Captain Hook or whatever, you can't go, oh, I'm really evil. I just walk around being really evil. You have to think, no, I'm the goodie. I'm not the baddie, I'm the goodie. And so, you know, if you're coming at it from that point of view, when you're writing, you sort of love the characters as you're writing them as well. You have an affection for them. And I think even in Prevenge, like, all the characters are pretty flawed. Every single person you meet is problematic in some way.
Completely.
But I sort of love them as well. And that was why I wanted to populate the film with my friends, actually.
Yeah.
You know, people like Joe Hartley and Tom Davis, who I didn't know that well, but, you know, I knew he's kind of a lovable guy performer, you know. So I knew that if you put sort of these lovable people within those characters, even though they're doing sort of despicable things or saying despicable things, you've got this tension then that you, which is real life, you know, that one minute you think someone's amazing and the next minute they do something and you think they're a, you know, a right, I don't know how much you swear in these.
You can swear all you like, go ahead.
I'm too embarrassed to say the word now, but, you know, I think that's real life and it's going against the film structure thing of like having a traditional protagonist antagonist. It's like
completely, and it makes it more engaging in many ways when it is just forcing people to accept that these villains and monsters aren't monsters. They're people. They're humans. They're normal people. They're not. They don't walk around and get up and go, oh, I'm gonna kill a cat. And then get, the dark things that happen as a one-off in what could be a nice life or as a mistake or whatever else. And I think it makes it more engaging.
It's a hangover of sort of probably religion, isn't it, in Christianity, that we sort of have this need to tell narratives where we go, they're definitely bad.
Yeah.
And we probably do that in our lives as well, as like, they said this thing to me, so they're horrible, I hate them now, they're on my shit list. And this person, although they're great, whatever they did, I'd like them, whatever they did. And actually, everybody's a mixture of those things.
Everyone's completely a mixture,
We find it hard, like, you know, reading in a newspaper, like, someone that we, you know, we've led to believe they're criminal and they're awful and that they once did something nice. And you're like, well, that's completely possible that someone could murder someone but do something nice for their granny. People are a mixture of all different qualities.
I think in many ways it's the strange arrogance of human nature, of us thinking that humans are these wonderful things, because we do have that belief that at the core, we're all good people. And I don't think we are. I think at the core, everyone is capable of being the most beautiful and wonderful person in the world. They're equally capable of dark, horrible things.
Yeah.
And children are a great example of this, in that they are these beautiful things. But equally, if you've got two small children and one takes the other one's toy, the other one's natural reaction is to punch them or lash out in some way.
Yeah.
And we spend a lot of time training them out of that and turning them into these people. But to say that human instinct is beautiful and selfless, it's not. It's something that we all work on a day-to-day basis, and that's a good thing and that should be applauded, but it should also be recognised that it is an effort and it is something that we work on as a society and as good humans rather than this natural thing.
A lot of exactly what you're saying went into the film, actually, because I was thinking so much about this thing as well. When you have a baby, you do, you know, I was scared of what was happening politically.
Yeah.
You know, even before, like, Donald Trump came into power, that happened when I turned up in America to promote the film.
Amazing.
And Donald Trump got in. I was like, why am I here?
Yeah.
This is so scary.
Can I leave immediately?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I was reading also, like, Hobbes. I've started doing things where I read a bit of philosophy about the films that I'm making, because in my old age, I'm getting much more into history and types of thinking and stuff. And I do think there is this movement now of like, especially what's happening politically, of like idealism's being really denigrated recently. Yeah. So denigrated that we believe even things that in the 60s were just normal, like, yes, we want a national health service and yes, we want this. Suddenly that's crazy and leftist,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, when did we start demonising idealism? Because for me, like, you aim at idealism, but you're never going to get it. But yeah. That doesn't mean you stop aiming for it.
No, completely.
And when you bring children up and you read them fairy tales, you're trying to encourage them to be idealists.
Yeah.
Everything that you teach a child is be good, share, do all these good things. And you're supposed to suddenly stop teaching people that when they get older.
Yeah.
Suddenly like, oh, that's ridiculous. All of that was just fairy tales. That's all nonsense.
Yeah.
You can abandon all of that now.
Yeah, completely. I mean, you blur out at the shades of grey to children because they can't conceive that, so you aim for the top. But it's ludicrous to start saying that as soon as you're aware that there's degrees that you shouldn't still want the very best as well. That should be what we aim for.
And just the idea of like teaching people the basics is like teaching manners, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's sort of like this is what we're aiming at, but pragmatism means we can't quite get to that point, but you still got to have those basic. And I just ended up having those kind of debates with people around the election of like people going, well, realistically, there's no money tree, there's no blah, blah. And you're sort of like, when did we stop having ideals? When is that? I don't know. I mean, for me, I'm really this is what I'm interested in with my next film as well, is this sort of romanticism, really.
Yeah.
I'm researching that a lot. It's, you know, not just romanticism in the idea of love and all of that, although that is part of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, idealism and having these sort of purity of intent about what you want.
Completely. I feel it's perfectly acceptable to lose a battle if your reason for entering that battle is correct and something that you believe in. So it shouldn't just be, oh, here's my belief, but am I going to win that way?
Mm.
What's that got to do with anything? If that's your belief, then that should be your belief. It shouldn't be... It's strange to break things down to, but can that belief a win? It's your belief, mate.
Mm.
It's what you believe in. So it shouldn't matter if it wins or loses. You should be doing everything you can to make it win, but that shouldn't be the defining thing on if that's your belief or not.
Yeah, I mean, and it's that thing of like you might fail as well. Like being an alcoholic, you might slip up and have like, you know, go back to the booze. You might have a belief and then, you know, not follow through on that belief, but you sort of go, right, I failed, but that's okay because I'm a human being.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to be good. And I think it's all that thing of like, you know, religion has gone from our lives. And I'm not religious.
Yeah.
But you do start to go, oh, there was loads of useful stuff about religion.
Completely. And people, like, I love Ricky Gervais. I think he's great. But one of his strongest arguments against religion is he always kind of says, I don't need religion to tell me what's good and bad.
Yeah.
I'm good because I choose to be good. But he's ignoring the fact that his values come from a society that is drenched in Christianity.
Mm.
So the reason he knows what's good and bad is down to religion, probably far down the line. So he's grown in a way that allows that.
And you're watching films that are informed by those tenets
completely,
as well.
Completely.
Like everything that we see, you know, you can root it back to Christianity at some point. You know, and I find all that stuff really interesting. I mean, I'm really into Alan Moore.
Yeah.
Who I just read an article by yesterday. And, you know, I love this thing that he has this sort of, you know, I'm going to really clumsily try to put in a nutshell what he's about, because he's like the genius. But for me, what I love about him is he sort of realises that, you know, as human beings, we're limited.
Yeah.
So we're limited by language. We're limited by our brains of how we can understand the world.
Completely.
And so he sort of goes, he almost goes, well, you go with that weakness. You know, if we've got a tendency to be into superstition or magical thinking, what can possibly be wrong about that?
100%.
When we do it naturally as human beings.
Yeah.
The way, science is limited. We're, you know, it's this sort of understanding that we're just little creatures.
Yeah, really. Yeah, no, completely. I'm going to put a caveat there that Alan was the third guest I ever had on podcast, and I recommend that people go and listen to it because there's a whole section at the end where he talks about magic, and it's something that I'd had on my notes, I'll talk to Alan about magic, but a little bit of it was, let's see what he says. And it's just beautiful and fascinating, and it's summed up perfectly. It goes back to when he got into comics, and the reason he got into comics was there was no restriction. At that point, in TV or film, there was a restriction on what you could do and what you could create, whereas in comics, you can make absolutely anything.
It's a complete world, isn't it? And it's visual, and it's, and the structures even. Yeah. Like you're bursting out of a box and bleeding
and going anywhere you want.
Box.
Yeah,
and,
completely.
I mean, I don't really know much about comic books. I'm totally out of my depth, but sometimes I think, oh, I wish I did know more.
Yeah.
I think it would be like, you know, suddenly deciding to learn a language or something or learn about a culture. It's like a huge undertaking to dive in when
completely.
You've never
it's knowing to respect that each art form can do things that other art forms can't. So I came up in spoken word, and it took me years to realise that there's stuff that written poetry can do that spoken word can't do because of the punctuation and the layout and things like that you can't do just speaking. Equally, there is the other way. But with Alan Moore, when he made The Watchmen, because that's the book that got me into Alan Moore, because I'd seen it was in Time magazine's top 100 novels. And I was like, but it's a comic. It was like, but it's in their top 100 novels of all time. Whatever.
Yeah.
I was like, that's amazing. And it's because it's a comic, and then it's got some files in it from a police report, and then it's got some news clippings and stuff like this. It's like, wow, this is this whole thing. It's
so
completely
rich.
It's its own medium. It came out of nowhere, and it's fascinating. What we were touching upon then, and we will get on some kind of track at some point, but the beauty of podcasts is you don't necessarily have to. Where we were talking about the reason for having your values being something further than just a winning an argument. A while ago, I got really into reading up on the experiments of Milgram, and the famous Milgram experiment is you're in a room and someone in a white coat is telling you to give an electric shock to someone in another room, and because you're being told and you can't see them, it allows further and further. But ages ago, I was developing a documentary with BBC Three, and they may be offended I talk about it now, but I walked away because they, at that point, were trying to direct it far too much.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's that thing that can happen with TV. It could be, here's my idea. They're like, how about we do this? And for me, I didn't have a desire to be a presenter. So I was like, oh no, I'll leave it then.
Yeah.
Which kind of shocked everyone, because it's like, you're walking. I was like, no, I wanted to make this. And you don't, so we won't.
Well, also, it's not a documentary, then, is it?
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
Following...
If we're changing the narrative. But one of the ones that came to mind, one of the things I planned out was another experiment of his was, he did an experiment where it was in New York, and it just had one person on the street just looking up at a skyscraper.
Mm.
And he'd see how many people that walked past would look. And then he'd do it again in another place where two people looking up. And I think it only had to get to four people to get 100% everyone that walks past would look up. So it's amazing that strength of the crowd. And the way I was going to adapt that was to use trains, because living in Essex, there's like the last train home can be an ugly, ugly place. And the idea was to be on a train and have one person drunk or whatever, nudge a stranger and go, like, fucking immigrants, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And again, in general, in that situation, I'd argue with them. I'd say no. But then would you, if there was two people going, yeah, they're immigrants, or not? Mm. And then three, and then four, and see where that point goes. And it's a fascinating one, because again, I'd like to believe that your argument is, unless there's a physical conflict there, your argument should remain, no matter how many people are disagreeing with you. But I'm also aware that that's not always as easy on a train at night. If everyone else is going, yeah, they're immigrants, I'd like to think I wouldn't join in, but I might not argue with everyone. But it's a tough one.
It's an interesting thing, because like recently, the whole sort of Jeremy Corbyn thing, I've seen people do complete volte-faces on Facebook. You know, they've gone from going, I hate him, he's ruining the Labour Party, when is he going to go, to going, oh, I saw him at Glastonbury.
Isn't he great?
And I'm sort of like, right, someone somewhere made it socially acceptable to you to do that, to go, oh, it's all right for middle class you know, 38-year-olds to support Jeremy Corbyn. It's not stupid.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting because it is... I mean, I think the thing is, like, it depends. I like to think of myself as, like, I do my own thing and I'm not influenced by other people, but I wonder if I've had a sort of training in that by being an outcast at school and,
being a weirdo.
I've sort of developed a bit of an armour of going, well, I don't do what other people do, so I, in that sense, kind of go, oh, well, I always thought he seemed like quite a nice man, so I was never influenced by people telling me not to like him, you know. But at the same time, like, I'm an actor as well, and sometimes I do feel like I get influenced, like, by people's accents and stuff. Like, if I'm in Manchester for 2 days, by the end of those 2 days, I will be doing a Manchester accent. Yeah. It might be a really bad accent, but I'm not doing it intentionally. It just happens.
Yeah.
And I just think that's like that group experiment, isn't it? It's like, it only takes me like 3 days to be in a bunch of people. I'm talking the same
I had a road trip a while ago, and it's going to sound like a name drop, but it's because of his addiction to that acting and mimicry. But I was on a road trip, it was just me and Tom Hardy, and we were going off up north, and we had about 4 hours driving, and he had to stop halfway through and apologise because I've got a stutter.
Mm.
And he was saying, I've noticed that I keep stuttering. I'm not mocking you. It's just because we're only in that company.
I think I've been doing it with you as well.
And again, it's an actress thing. It's just that thing you just start, but you have that in there.
It's an empathy thing as well.
Yeah.
I'm flushing myself now. I'm so empathetic. I'm not, but I do. You know, there's like this test that if you see someone yawning and if you yawn, it means you're empathetic. And
Fascinating.
If I see someone... I mean, I think a lot of people do it, and so it's quite a standard test. If you don't yawn, it might mean you're a psychopath or something. It's because I like people. I mean, I generally sort of go, I like you, therefore I want to be a bit more like you.
Yeah.
And then I might unconsciously have the same body posture as them. And But I think that is probably a skill then that lends itself to acting. Or not even a skill. It might be something that actually gets you into trouble as well in various ways. It might be something that isn't that great.
If you're suddenly doing an accent somewhere you shouldn't be doing an accent, but you've just naturally done it, and it feels like mockery. I've had that before, where I'll mimic thinking, because I'm just thinking to myself, and then I'll be like, oh, that sounds like I'm taking the piss. That sounds like I'm just doing,
Someone said to me, like an Australian girl that I used to live with, she said, I'm going to do it now. People just constantly impersonate my accent, and I just find it quite rude. And I, you know, would people do that to everybody that they met? And I was like, do you know what? You should take it as a compliment, because people actually like Australians.
Yes. Yeah.
People generally like Australians. And if people are impersonating your accent, it's because they like you.
Yeah.
And they think that you won't be offended because they like you. If they were worried you were going to be offended, they would not. If they felt alien to you, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, but they think that you're going to be all right with it because they think you're so friendly.
They'd do it when you can't hear it.
Yeah,
or they'd be doing it offensively. Yeah. They're doing it in front of me. Behind your back,
this German girl said to me, you know, you might well be doing that in a traditional, you know, xenophobia against Germans.
It's all fascinating the way voices and ways of speaking can affect people as so much. Like, I genuinely, I've thought about it on the podcast front. I think having a stutter helps me, because I think it does put people at ease, because there is that kind of, there's that empathy there. Not that I'm intentionally painting myself as this poor stuttering boy on cue, as this poor stuttering boy. But again, I think it makes it, it's then not intimidating. I'm not there. I'm not here questioning you and quizzing you. We're having this chat.
I definitely think that's true. I mean, I think that I get stuff wrong in my grammar quite often.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I know what the correct thing is because I will write it correctly.
Yeah.
But I do generally think that I don't want people to find me intimidating.
Yeah.
And I don't like it when people talk in a way that is deliberately intimidating or exclusive, in a way that I feel like... So I think that is something that... Yeah, that's another thing that I'm trying to... I'm a people pleaser at the end of the day.
Yeah,
it's not always a good thing.
It's a fascinating one. Again, not that we'll stay on this subject for the whole thing, but I always notice that when I'm in South London and with people from South London, I become more South London, because it's that natural thing of trying to... I've got roots here. It's trying to make everyone more comfortable and feel okay. I want to touch upon... You mentioned... kind of growing up as an outcast at school, and I want to
painted by a picture there.
I want to get into that in more detail. But before I do, do you feel there's been a conscious effort, and possibly influenced by that, to talk about things like death and darker subjects in the art that you create? Because Sightseers and Prevenge are great examples of that, of really matter-of-fact discussions of death. And I think, I for one think it's a really important thing to do, because I think we make too much of a taboo of it. So has that been a conscious thing, or has it just been, oh, that happens to be what I've written about and interested
it's
in?
It's funny, because I don't really know. Like, people have asked me, why do you do stuff that's so dark? And I'm like, oh, is it because I'm a bit of a goth? I don't know. Yeah. Like, I enjoy dark fairy tales. I've always enjoyed that kind of thing. But actually, I was thinking about it more deeply the other day, and I was thought, actually, I'm quite a fearful person.
Right.
And I think a lot of directors are as well. If you've got quite a lot of imagination, a lot of my time is spent thinking about things that can go wrong.
Yeah.
Someone else might see, oh, look, there's that lovely tree over there. And I might go, it's got some very low-lying branches, though, that are quite spiky. So that could go in someone's eye.
That's dangerous.
And that's what I'll be thinking about, genuinely. And I think that, in some ways, that is why the films that I do have like, these sort of quite horrible things happening in it, because I'm sort of... That is genuinely how I think.
Yeah. Do you adore the Final Destination films then? Because they're just the ultimate that it's going, what can we make go wrong in this room?
A plane, it's going to crash.
That's it. Well, Final Destination is extended versions of the opening scene of Casualty in a Hollywood manner. It's just going, let's make the crazy things all fall apart and go wrong.
Probably. Yeah, well, I don't know if I enjoyed those films. Is that the right word? Maybe if I watched my own films, I wouldn't enjoy them. I don't know. It's like people talk about what happens to Tom Davis and they're like, oh, I really cringed. Do you still cringe? And I'm a bit like, no, because I know it wasn't real.
Yeah.
So it's like, I just think about, you know, that bit that went wrong because the cardboard knife went all floppy and stuff like that.
Yeah, you've got that greater awareness. So when you're writing, is there a thought of how people are going to react, or is it purely writing to please you? Yourself at the time?
I think I do. I mean, in my dreams, I would always make stuff that I want to see. Mm-hmm. I think there's all sorts of pressures upon you in TV and film of making something different to what you actually want to see. And I think that's always the battle that I have. It's like, well, this is what I think's good, and someone else is telling me it's wrong, or that it's not quite good enough, or, you know, whatever. But I always try and make stuff that I want to see, but at the end of the day, I'm a live performer as well. That's where I started out, was doing theatre and comedy. And I always think about the audience reaction. To me, that's it's all about the audience reaction.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm trying to press buttons with people.
So that's
always a consideration. But it's almost like I'm sort of thinking of it as being like a ghost train or a roller coaster or something. It's like I'm thinking, well, they've had a bit of that, so I want to take them somewhere else now, and I want to do a bit of this and a bit of that. And to me, I'm like, I'm hoping I'm giving them their money's worth by taking them through a range of experiences.
Exactly that. Again, I think that comes across of it being a journey of emotions rather than just where do I get the next laugh. Weirdly, my first viewing of Sightseers was ruined a little bit because I went to see it at the Odeon, the Panton Street one, so just off Leicester Square.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a guy in there who was really laughing belly laughs
like
constantly.
A bit too early.
And that was it. The thing was, it's the kind of humour that isn't laughter track type humour. It is kind of like, it's stuff that I would go away and tell people about instantly and be excited, but it's, I don't know, it's a lot of it. There's a few points, obviously, but a lot of it isn't written as these big belly laughing. So it was one that I then was keen to go and watch at home as soon as it came out, because I was like, I found myself railing against enjoying it because of how much he was enjoying it. I mean, that was good, but come on. It's like, no, I now need to watch it and just enjoy it. So, yeah.
Well, also, you don't want to feel like there's expectation, because that's what I really felt
forced into it.
Yeah, in Prevenge, I was like, I don't really write thinking, how am I going to make people laugh, really? I mean, I sort of go, oh, that's a funny joke, or that's a funny situation or something, but I'm not all the way through going, oh, this isn't funny enough. I don't care, actually, that much. I mean, other people will care more, I suppose. But I'm just going, what's a good story? What's truthful emotionally for the character? Now, that was a bit of a fear about the film, was the serious bits in it. Like, are people going to swallow it? And for me, it's sort of like, I just want to surprise people, you know, want to feel Like, people are like, oh, I thought that bit was going to be funny, but she's quite sad. And the, you know, like, it's refreshing in that way, yeah, then to watch. And I feel like at this point in time with film and TV, that's the way it's going, that people want to be surprised by what's happening next. And
completely. You don't... I feel you don't need to answer the question, is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Is it this? Is it that?
Mm.
Because everything's so accessible now. It's like, well, just watch it.
Yeah.
So you can watch it on demand. Available now on Sky On Demand and on iTunes and in many other places. you can watch it that instantly. So the time you could spend having a discussion on what kind of film it is, just go and watch it.
Yeah.
You'll find out. It's kind of, I like that.
And don't categorise your experience as well. It's like this weird thing of like, well, of course you're going to be disappointed if you walked in going, it's going to be a comedy and
here's
I didn't get
I
a
wanted.
Comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like just open yourself up to watching a film. You know, we were talking about early films and, you know, that 1961 film you're talking about. You're like, imagine the audience experience of seeing that film and really not having seen that story before.
Yeah.
It must have been amazing.
Completely. And it was, I mean... Just to give some context, it was a film called Victim, which was the first film. It was while homosexuality was still illegal. And it's actually cited by a lot of people as having an influence on bringing along that law change.
Mm.
And it was one of the first to have sympathy for homosexuals, for these criminalist homosexuals kind of thing. And again, I love the excitement of that. And I think a film recently, Get Out, was a great example were saying... Mm. I was hearing all this hype, but the first friend I knew that saw it said, try not to read anything
don't
about
read
it.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was like, right, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a comedy. I don't know if it's a horror. I don't know if it's an action.
Yeah,
just going to go and enjoy
it. Give yourself
it.
That present to not know what you're about to see.
Yeah.
And imagine that you've never seen a film before. You've never, you know, you're just... Because I think we're so saturated now. We've watched so many films. We've watched so many, you know, we're bombarded with stuff. I've got a watching list that's like as long as my arm of stuff that I haven't seen and I've got to watch. But yeah, being able to go in and going, I've got no idea what it's going to be. And I'm enjoying that I don't know what...
This is going to sound like a plug now, and it's not. But I've mentioned on the podcast before, about a year ago now, the podcast was sponsored by Odeon and their Limitless Card thing.
Oh, right, yeah.
And they sent me one. And... It's fine if you want a card, buy one. If you don't. But the thing that it did for me was it took the pressure off of a film.
Yeah.
Because I can watch anything.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. And that sounds...
So you just give it a go.
Really odd. Mm. But psychologically, it made me go, if I've got a couple of hours spare in London, oh, what's on? Not, is there a film I want to watch?
Yeah.
Oh, what's on? And
absolutely.
It was really a refreshing thing because it made me go into films with that bit more of a... All right,
well,
there's no...
Genre.
I've not got this
pre-expectation. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I've sort of exploited genre in a way with the films that I've done, and it's worked well for me. But as soon as genre starts blocking off your empathy, you know, it's like you should be able to walk into a film and go, I'm open to this character's experience and where they're going to take me and this story. I'm not going to go, I can't enjoy this. Like, I hate that when someone goes... I couldn't enjoy this because it was a Western and I hate Westerns. And you're like, what? You couldn't follow the character?
I'm so sorry for you,
yeah, and just like because there was some sand and a horse in it.
It ruined it completely. That's it.
You know, and it's like when genre becomes that you decided I'm not going to enjoy that film, that's not a good thing. And you know,
completely.
For me, I'm always trying to trick people into empathising with a character they didn't think they could empathise with. And I think that's probably what Get Out has done, because we've been so badly trained to only identify with a character who looks in a certain way,
you know,
that is basically Tom Cruise or whatever, that our habits are really bad, our viewing habits of like, oh, well, he's a black character, so he'll die. In the horror film, you know, or sci-fi. That's the joke that, you know, that the black character, oh, he's going to die.
He'll be first dead,
And I don't know what happens in Get Out, so
it's fine.
No spoilers. He might die, who knows, but hopefully it's the end of the film rather than the beginning. But but all of that stuff that kind of snaps you out of like, and I think it's you know, this is what I think about film is it's a tool. It's a tool for empathy, which a book is as well, or a novel. It's like an important sort of human experience of like going, if we could all identify a little bit more with each other and empathise with each other a bit more, the world would be a better place.
Yeah.
So here's a film that's going to help you to do that.
Yeah.
And And I think, like, probably in the 80s, there were certain issues films, or 80s or 90s, like Philadelphia or something,
make
you like, oh, an AIDS victim. Okay, now I feel like I know that person and I can relate.
Way, yeah.
And I think it's more subtle what we're doing now. It's kind of films that are still issues films, but they're sort of disguised as genre.
And
that's kind of quite interesting. And that's sort of what Prevenge is. I don't go out my way to make some sort of tract that is preaching to people about feminism or motherhood or anything like that. I just write what I want to write and that I enjoy writing. But at the same time, all of those things, there's political threads running through it. How can you help it?
Prevalent to you as a human. So that those threads are going to
lead into it. It's just what's in your head. It's just what's in the zeitgeist in the moment of what's concerning people. I mean, my boyfriend's family came from Australia and they were saying, it's really funny, everyone's talking about politics here. Like, people don't talk about politics in Australia. And I was like, well, that's because of what's happening. It's just this is the climate that you can't avoid it. You know, it's like, I've never seen so many young people being so engaged with politics.
But again, you rewind 10 or 15 years and it wasn't a topic that was prevalent and was all over things. It's weird how these things have cycles and you kind of have to have some bad to make people care.
It always
concerns me how bad it has to get before people care enough to really do something. I mean, at the moment, we all care enough to write some Facebook posts, but is that making a big difference? Is that concern of mine has always been, and I've told some friends this, and every time something bad happens, people are like, oh, you must be loving it. It's like, no, I'm aware. My awareness is that I feel it has to get a lot worse, but that doesn't mean I'm looking forward to it in any way. It's just, I think it is that kind of thing of, in a comfortable Western society, it's going to take a lot to shake us out of our armchairs.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I get guilt about it. Like, a few years ago, I had real guilt about it. I'd just done Sightseers and I was working quite a lot and I was doing a TV show and I really felt like, oh, this industry is quite selfish and horrible, actually. I don't know. It was a tough time for me. Weirdly, it was like a big time in my career, like, success-wise, or from the outside, probably. Yeah. People were like, oh, that's great, you won some awards and stuff. But actually, internally, I was like, oh, my God, if I'm going to carry on working this industry, I'm going to have to develop a bit more of a philosophy about what I'm doing, because this is actually quite a dark world to work in. I just felt that way, that, oh my God, I've got access into this world, but it's
quite a cutthroat.
And it's that whole thing about holding on to your principles and stuff like that, and it's cutthroat. And it was funny because I was working with this actress and she was sort of probably late 60s, and I was talking about it like, oh, I don't really know how to cope with this, and she said to me, oh, well, I'm a Buddhist and I've been a Buddhist since 1977 or something. And I will bring you a book that explains how you deal with all this stuff.
Yeah.
And she brought me this book on Buddhism, and it was amazing. And it's a very pragmatic branch of Buddhism, this particular Buddhism that she follows. And there was loads of stuff in there that I was like, oh, it's like a manual of how to deal with all the crap that happens to you.
Yeah.
Because it's all about very human emotions, like jealousy or, you know, envy or anger or any of these things. But one of the things that he said, there's all these different levels towards enlightenment. The top one is nirvana and enlightenment. But there's one sort of a couple further down, which is called bodhisattva.
Right.
And it's this idea that if you have a purpose in your life, that that's sort of good enough. Or that's how I read it. It's sort of like, you might have a purpose in your life and it might be just being a good mum.
Yeah.
But you know what? That's all right.
Yeah.
If that's your chosen purpose, that's enough. You don't have to go out and be a political activist as well as all of those things.
Completely.
You don't have to. And it was really funny because I read that and I thought, maybe my bodhisattva, however you say it, maybe that's going to be making films.
Yeah.
And I actually felt like I can deal with that because, you know, sometimes I'm feeling like, yeah, I should be taking to the streets and protesting about this and that. And like,
it's weird. I mean, you spoke of the filmmaking industry, and it is under a microscope all the more. But it's also something in society now with social media, is there is that constant comparison to what other people are doing.
Mm.
So, and again, it's something I don't like. I think it's fine to go and protest, but you don't have to. It's fine to donate to charity, but you don't have to. You're not a bad person if you don't. There shouldn't be these things of this is what you should do. And it's an interesting one because it relates to the entertainment world, because there's exactly that. You could absolutely, you've just done Sightseers, you've won awards as a writer and as an actress and all this kind of thing, but are you doing anything production-wise? Are you producing anything? Do you know what I mean? There's always these things of... There's always something else
that they want you to do.
There's a Mitch Hedberg joke where he said... It's a weird thing with comedians. They go, oh, you do comedy, but can you act or can you write? And he was like, you never go to a chef and go, you're amazing, world-class chef, but can you farm? It's like,
what about gardening?
No, exactly. It's that weird thing in the entertainment industry that as soon as you achieve something somewhere, there's this expectation that you should be achieving it, it somewhere else as well. It's like, no, you could. It can just be that what you're doing is your goal.
I just think success in life, or which, you know, should be happiness, is actually about editing.
Yeah.
It's all about editing. I mean, editing is a very powerful process in filmmaking. You know, I work with an absolutely brilliant editor called Matteo Bini, who did Prevenge. It's a very careful, you know, difficult skill, but I sort of think in life, if we just let ourselves off a little bit more and because this is what I'm finding at the moment, I'm getting a lot of meetings and I'm sort of going, I really need to kind of work out which of these meetings is really for their sake as well as my own, because I'm like, I could go to this meeting and nothing could come of it because I'm so swamped in my brain. I'm so cluttered. That actually I don't end up actually, and then it's a waste of both of our times, you know. So it's sort of like being selective of, and I think the people that really do what they want to do are brilliant at editing their lives, at selecting where am I going to make an effect, where am I actually going to do something at the right time in the right moment.
Completely.
I mean, and also that thing of like, you know, doing a podcast, even, you know, something like this is. It's enough to be someone who's got an open mind and questioning things and encouraging other people to be like that. That's putting good into the world as I see it. You know, it's not, you don't have to be sort of like storming Westminster with a torch in your hand. Injustice.
But it's having that confidence in what it is you want to do and the importance of that. I had Sophia Batella on the podcast a few weeks back, and she told an amazing, really inspirational story to me that she was touring the world as a dancer for Madonna, and she went in one day and she said to Madonna, I'm leaving the tour because I'm going to act. And Madonna was like, this is amazing, have you got a good role then, have you got this, because she'd done a few bits, and she was like, no, I've just decided that that's what I'm going to do. And it wasn't with any solid plan there, it was just she realised that was her goal. And she needed to focus on that. Yeah. And while she had all these other opportunities, she edited them all out and went, here's where I want to be. And that's a powerful thing, I think. And
it's like you hear stories of people who lose their jobs. And sometimes you go, maybe you needed to lose your job.
100%. Because what did you actually want to do? Like,
you know, maybe they didn't like their job or whatever. And it is that thing of like, you know, it took me a long time to direct or accept that I wanted to direct.
Yeah.
You know, that was a difficult thing for me because, you know, to an extent when you're an actress, you're quite passive. It's someone else coming and telling you what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way, you're like a little dolly going, pick me, play with me today, please. Like, find me the most interesting dolly that you have. And see,
how would you like me to be?
Yeah, exactly. What do you want me to wear to be in this role? And yeah, it is quite passive. And I mean, I love acting. I absolutely love acting. But I knew that I've got more bossiness in me. than I was showing, really. And really, like, you know, as I said, like doing Prevenge, it kind of, that was a thing that sort of forced me into going, you like being in control. You like choosing the music and the making the decisions.
Yeah.
And actually, you've been a little bit naughty and a bit lazy in not doing this earlier, you know, and not taking control of your destiny.
It's having the boldness to take the risk as well, isn't it? Because I think when you're the doll, if it doesn't work out, there's a lot of elements outside of your controls. So you can feel a level of,
it's not my fault.
That didn't do great, it's not my fault. Whereas when you're going, no, I'm in control now, you succeed or fail on your own back. And that's an exciting thing, but it's also a big step to take.
I mean, I had a lot of respect for directors at that point when you're premiering your film and you're sweating, you're thinking about the first reviews and you're just really going, oh my God, this is horrendous.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think it only gets worse because you... Not that it's a great hardship to be directing your own films, it's like a lovely situation to be in, but you know, I think the first one people are impressed because it's new and it's like a first one and you've done it under certain constraints. Then the second one they're like, is this any better? I'm gonna be a bit tougher on them now. You know, they've graduated a
it's
little
that
bit.
Obsession with comparison, isn't it?
Yeah,
so the other one hasn't gone like you have that with, again, just coming from music as well, you'll always, anytime you release an album, they'll be like, I prefer your second album. It'll be like, that's cool, that's still there.
Said that the first time.
It's still there, you can still listen to that. It's not gone.
Yeah.
This is additional to it. That's
yes,
not,
it's
I've,
true,
it's not
it?
Removed. I've not recorded this over your copy of the first album. This is, it's a separate CD. It's fine.
It's like an obsession of people thinking that you're on one trajectory. You've got to get better. You can't have any deviation. 100%. And like, you know, and actually the reality of like a creative career is there's always ups and downs. It's like you don't have any control over that. It's just what's happening. And I think actually once you realise that, of like, I don't really have that much control over my ideas. I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, the thing that I'm doing next, I don't know why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
A psychologist could probably tell me better than that, than I know. It's just, and I think actually that's quite a nice place to be if you sort of feel like I'm just channeling some stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not actually that responsible for it. I am responsible. Obviously, I'm going to be responsible when I get the bad reviews or whatever. But, it's this thing of thinking you're just trying to channel something that is maybe in the ether that's interesting you or you think is going to be interesting to other people. And you're just trying to be truthful to that. I think the really bad stuff comes when you stop listening to that higher voice that is telling you what to do. And instead, you're worrying about the audience or the reviewer. Like, what would they like to see? What... You're thinking too much about the critical voice instead of just being honest and sincere about what the story is.
About what you're creating. And again, I think another key is potentially the awareness that it's essentially a never-ending story, that you will be doing a project after this as well, and you will be doing a project after this. And let's kind of rewind back a little bit, because I think it's prevalent in this situation, that you work all this time to get to somewhere where there's a project. I like Sightseers, that's critically acclaimed, that wins awards, that's adored, and then you just continue. Do you know what I mean? I think there's probably this belief that when that happens, everything changes.
Yeah.
The world's different. I'm now a superstar. But in general, that's not the case. It continues on. And there might be some slight changes and some more meetings, but you're still having to work and create, and it's not this. So was that something that you
experienced? I've made that mistake, I think. And I think, again, it's our human instinct to turn stuff into narratives, turn stuff into films. This great thing happened, and then they had a happy ending, and then it was happy ever after. And, you know, after Sightseers, I didn't really get any work. Like, for ages, I got no acting work for about 2 years. It was really weird. I felt really down about it. I'd got stuff that I'd already been slated to do from before, but I didn't get that moment of, like, you know, Woody Allen phoning me up or Steven Spielberg going, hi, you've made it, come to Hollywood. You know, it was just like back to the drawing board.
Do you think you can identify in any way, looking back, what might have influenced that? Because just my own curiosity is, would there be any element of maybe you have a success and you take your foot off the gas slightly, and not saying you specifically, but in general, if you've not had a success, then you're chasing every single role. Then when you have something, you suddenly think, well, the next thing is going to be bigger or huger, and maybe you're ignoring the smaller things that you might have jumped on previously.
I think it's something about the unusual quality of that project.
Yeah.
Where, you know, as we were talking about, the characters
are so
weird. Yeah. The characters are so strange. I think a lot of people would watch that film and just go, you are those people.
100%.
So you might be terrible actors. 100%. You know, I don't want to see you as anything else.
It's the feeling I get of Shane Meadows' films and casts. They're so beautiful and so perfect, but they're so good that it feels like he's just turned up with a camera and that's who they are.
Yeah.
Therefore, you might not see them in another role as nothing, which people like Vicky McClure and Stephen Graham and all these have shown is completely wrong. But I can see how that could be the case at first. Well, you're like, well, I don't want Combo from This Is England in this film. He's not right for it. And then,
because he's not an actor. He's just a real person.
He's a person. He's a real... Yeah, the characters are so real. So in a way, it's a victim of your own success.
By saying that. But I think there probably was an element of that.
Completely. Because it felt so real and so human. I said, because despite the extremities that it goes to, it's all done in such a matter-of-fact way that it is so relatable and human that, again, it is almost a victim of your own success there. You've done it so well.
I was watching With Nell and I again, a couple of weeks ago, which just, we started having sort of movie nights, which is absolutely brilliant. I recommend it. Like, get off Facebook and just have a movie night.
Yes.
You've been doing it loads. Yeah, and, you know, With Nell and I, you kind of go, most amazing performances. What did those actors go on to do? I mean, they had a little bit of success, but, you know, you would have thought it would propel them, but actually what they're doing is so sort of human and raw and empathetic and real that you just kind of almost, they are those characters, they're kind of frozen in that time.
Yeah.
And so I flatter myself that that was the situation, but I actually think it's really good for me. Whenever I've done stuff that's been successful, like Garth Marenghi, and quite often those things have been strange and unusual, so they don't have a mainstream success. They have like a cult appeal that then continues.
Again, I was going to say a slow build and a slow burn success, and Garth Marenghi is a prime example of that. That it's and similarly, I mean, as we were saying, how the entertainment industry can be very self-driven and singular, but projects like Garth Marenghi and projects like Hot Fuzz and World's End and stuff like that seem to be the exceptions to that rule, where it feels like groups of people all going, let's all make something, rather than it's a Tom Cruise film, it's this film. It's like, no, everyone kind of are putting it together.
Yeah, mucked in, and it's got a personality.
Like, yeah.
You know, or I sort of think as well, I'm a character actress, and sometimes people don't, they're sort of scared of the idea that you've got, that you're bringing a personality to a film. And like, you know, I always used to flatter myself of like, I'm a chameleon. I can look so different. I can do different accents. And actually, I think really what I bring to something is probably similar energy each time, even if I'm doing a different performance. And actually, people can be a bit scared of that. They actually want you to be more bland.
Yeah.
Sometimes, especially female performers, I think, which is a bit of a shame. They're like, yeah, we want the wife, but we generally want her to look like a model. And that's it. There's no character.
Yeah.
And you're like, but why does he love her? Why does this guy love her? And I mean, that was what was so lovely about Sightseers. Is like, even though it's a dark film, apologies, that's just film four executive walking out in the house. No, I think that was what was so weird about Sightseers, but appealing, is like, and to me, this was like the meaning of it, is it is a rom-com in some ways. It's about a romantic relationship. And the idea that as flawed as these two people are, they've got is each other.
Yeah.
And I sort of think that is what a relationship is when you realise that the flaws of that person you are as in love with as the good things about that
completely,
person.
Completely, completely.
So suddenly having in a film like a wife that's just completely perfect, you sort of go, well, that's not what a relationship's about.
It's not real in any way.
Yeah, it's like, that's a trophy. That's not a real person. So I don't know, I kind of... You know, as I get older and I'm sort of a bit more like, I used to bemoan that I wasn't cast in more stuff, just generally. Yeah. And now I'm sort of like, no, the people that cast me and stuff actually know what I can bring to the project.
Yeah.
And if they don't know what I'm going to bring, then they're probably not going to like working with me. It's not the right, it's not going to be the right combination. And so I feel like probably the projects I've done, I've been the right ones. They've been you know, what I don't think... I don't think I would change anything, really, because it's all been, like, personal development for me as well. Like, coming to know what it is I do and what I'm good at and not beating myself up about.
And the timing of it all, you know, from looking over, again, the lazy prep of going through IMDb, it feels like that thing of... As the roles were coming... Or as the roles were developing and getting more and more, it was, again, it seemed like a lot of these quite safe places to develop and to learn your trade all the more and to get better and better. And then, I'm writing my own stuff. I'm at the front. I'm here.
It's been like a school. It's been like, because I've worked with so many people that I've worked with again. And then there's this real trust relationship, which is so important to just have that trust and that comfort when you're working with someone. And that knowledge of their abilities and their skills. And so I sometimes like, you know, when, because I made the film Revenge really quickly, I'm like, yeah, but, you know, 15 years of study, really, of like being an actress,
being on set,
writing. You know, it took me 15 years to write a film in 2 weeks. You know, all the experience that I'd had and watching other directors and sort of being able to cherry pick, oh, I like the way they work in this way, or I've learned this thing, or they said this thing to me, which has stayed with me. That's all really, really important.
Completely. It's all a combination of things that have happened in your past and have built up to that and prepared you for that moment. When Riz Ahmed was on, he was saying how annoyed he was in his first few films that he would learn the scripts inside and out, and his literally first two or three roles, they didn't do a single line off the script. And he was like, he'd spend so much time learning this and suddenly, but it meant that he's then that prepared. He's so prepared to go off script, to be ready. And then if they need to click back, he can pull things back.
But it also means that he knew who the character was. It's internal already. All of that, he's internalised all of that stuff. That's his sort of Bible of who that character is. It's just inside him. And I think that's the thing that when I'm not a classical screenwriter. I'm not a classical actress either. I'm not the perfect person to come and go, I will be so, you know, I will deliver this script like this finely tuned instrument that just turns this script into a brilliant performance. It's like, I'll bring something strange to it, or more to it, or, you know, I kind of bring what I think is an internal kind of thing of what I think the character is. And I bring a liking of that character as well. I really, you know, I feel like I'm on that character's side and I'm fighting in their corner.
Even if they're
even if the director's like, you know, maybe I don't want to like them.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have no choice. Like, this character's real. Like, I'm defending them.
I love that.
I don't know. I mean, it's funny because I feel like actually having made Revenge, ironically, I'm much more confident about my acting now.
That's great.
I had many years of kind of like, you know, especially in the comedy world, like people would say, you're a really good actress, you know, as if that's completely separate.
It's a shock and comedy. A different thing.
And so that would give me like some false hope.
That's what I was here to do.
I'm like, why wouldn't I be? I try to do everything well if I can. I don't want to do one bit
that's
of it badly.
Aim.
Yeah. But, you know, they'd sort of raise my hopes that I'd think, oh, you know, one day I'm going to be a serious actress because everyone's telling me that I can act well. I actually don't think I am that great an actress, really, but I, as I said, like, as I get older, I sort of know when, that part, I could do that. And that person, I would have a good working relationship
with. It's great to have that awareness and be able to go, I can do something good with that, rather than just, I could do that. I could do that if you want that. I can be that. But I can do something really good with this role and kind of take it somewhere.
I think also it's this thing of like, I know that I'm not very good at... Someone once said to me, and it was quite funny, a producer like really early on, he said, you're like the dog in Wizard of Oz because you come on stage and you think you're the star, even though you're just the dog.
Amazing.
And then before everyone knows it, everyone's looking at the dog.
Yeah.
So he's basically calling me a dog. Which I was remarkably unoffended by. But I'm sort of like, I am a bit like that. It's like, if I'm playing a small part, I'm like, I'm not trying to steal the scene, but I am going to think that I am, because everybody thinks they're the most important person in their
Completely.
Own life.
Completely. But I think it's key to the role. I've mentioned this a few times, again, in my incredibly limited acting experience. If you are in the background, just to make the day go quicker, it's more fun to make that your role.
Yeah.
So in your mind, you're playing the lead role in your character's film. It happens at that point, you're in the background somewhere, but you're playing the lead there. And I think that's a good outlook to have, you know, it's adding as some depth. And it's depth that 90% of the people are watching might not catch or might ignore because they're so focused on what's going on in the foreground. Yeah. But if anyone wants to, it makes that scene real. Because in general, in our lives, none of us are standing in the background. As you said, all of us are in the foreground because we're in our own heads.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, people are probably listening going, God, I wouldn't hire her as an actress because she'd be like...
What are these show stealers going on about?
Steal focus or whatever. But I just think it's fun as well, isn't it? It's like you just want to have fun and go,
just
like,
enjoy
this person is, you know, they are like a dog is having fun when it goes on stage.
Completely.
And like, as an actor, you're like, well, at some level, I just enjoy this. I enjoy people... giving me attention.
Yeah.
And if you don't, if you're not aware of that, that's not a good thing, I think. For someone to go, oh no, I'm so humble. And,
so is that, you know. No, you're not. You're loving it. You're having a great time. You're playing about on stage.
Yeah.
We're coming towards the end. Before we do, I want to go all the way back and just find a little bit about your kind of, your upbringing. And was comedy always a big influence as a child? You grew up in Coventry, was it?
I was born in Coventry, and then we moved to Canilworth, which is a sort of small town outside Coventry.
Lovely.
Which I've got a real fondness for. My mum and dad still live there, and it's kind of an interesting place. It's sort of upwardly mobile now, but it's that sort of, everybody knew each other, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, it still makes me laugh now, because my mum, unless I'm in the Kenilworth Weekly News... it hasn't happened. Like, my mum will literally say, will they do a piece about it in the Kenilworth Weekly News? And I'm like, I don't know, mum. I don't really read it.
So. Be tempted to big time? Because I had a weird thing the other day. A mate of mine, my mate Stu, his brother is lovely. He's a deaf lad. He's a lovely guy. And he sent me a link literally yesterday to our local paper. And it was a mention of the podcast. And as we record this, last week's podcast got, because of some drama in it, got covered by CNN,
really?
BBC News, Australian news stations, everyone, The Guardian, everyone was doing articles on this particular thing. And I had to bite, and again, it felt like such arrogance, but I had to bite my tongue to not respond, going, the local paper, excuse me, here's a few articles. But I did, I resisted. I just wrote back, oh, that's cool, man. But yeah, it is that weird one. And it should be that it's exciting when something comes into your world. So if that's your mum's world, then that's the one that's exciting,
when
right?
When you were a little kid, that would have been really exciting. 100%. So you're like, wow, I think
clippings somewhere of when my first band, who never ended up playing a gig, were in two of my local papers, just in the listings. It wasn't even a write-up or a review, it's just the listings, and it meant the world. So, again, it should mean something.
I remember going to see
excitement.
A local panto, which was Amdram, and it was like people's parents, like people from my school. And but to me, they were like stars, you know? They were like a sort of 50-year-old woman dressed as Jack and the Beanstalk, whatever.
Amazing.
I was like, wow, she's incredible. Like, she was like a superstar in my mind. But like,
so in your small town, was that the kind of thing that was appealing to you, or did you have other goals? Or
I did. I was a member of an acting club, and to my mind, I was quite a lazy child, and like, so I didn't really go for, like, I did a bit of piano, but I never practiced because I was too lazy. Whereas acting, it was like you could turn up and you do stuff, and people would be quite impressed, and you didn't have to practice.
So
I think that was like one of the hobbies that stuck with me, because. Yeah, I didn't have to practice, and I found it like, it seems quite easy.
There's something like, that you can get praise for, but not have to learn initially. Because again, I think as children, we are naturally, we're learning how to act every day. Like in day-to-day life, as much as anything else, you're learning how to act around people at school, around parents, around this. So it's, you're at that stage anyway, so it's that bit easier, I guess.
And
so.
I think I was quite grown up when I was little. I sometimes said I looked like a 26-year-old when I was like 8.
Amazing.
I just had a 26-year-old head. And I think I've been becoming like less mature as
brilliant.
You know, more childish as the years have gone on to make up for lost time. But back then, I think I had this sort of sense of awareness that everyone's being silly. You know, so I was like, I used to do quite dry comedy at this club, you know, like I used to sort of almost do like a pastiche of like the sketches that other kids would do.
Amazing.
Because they'd be like going, you borrowed my hairdryer. It would always be a sketch about someone having borrowed someone's hairdryer.
Yeah.
It'd be an argument. And me and my friend would do a sort of ironic take of that where something weird would happen. So we were sort of doing comedy without really knowing it. But I was watching a lot of Vic and Bob. Like that was a big mind-blowing thing for me, like Big Night Out. Because I really did go, this is the stuff that me and my friends... do.
Yeah.
Just surreal, strange drawings and talking about surreal stuff, but yeah. someone's doing it on telly, and that means it's comedy, and that means it's worth something, yeah. you know. And, you know, I watched the Monty Python and
yeah.
all of that. I would just, any comedy that was on, I would be on it, you know.
Bob were a great one, inspiration-wise, because it's exactly that. Everything that they did, you could look at and go, that could be me and my mates. And yeah. it's not. And they nailed it.
Doing it to but quite you could a
watch
level.
It and go, I could hit someone with a giant frying pan.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I mean, you could, but you didn't. Yeah, yeah, it's exactly. kind of this. It's this
yeah, so it's this illusion that you're thinking that it's what you could
it's
do.
Simple
obviously,
and easy,
they've
yeah.
got quite a lot of stagecraft yeah, and like yeah, yeah. stuff going on that is clever. But I think it for me, it was like, I guess it was our generation's Monty Python or something. It was this surrealism, which, you know, now I'm still really interested in surrealism. And it's not something that I explore a little bit, actually, with film. You can, like, mix surrealism
yeah.
and realism. You yeah. can do that. You can have metaphors and you can have visual strangeness and all sorts of things. But on TV, I was sort of in an era where there was, like, The Mighty Boosh, which I was in.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of like, that's it for surrealism. You don't yeah. get to do any more yeah. surrealism yeah. now. We've ticked that box with this show.
Yeah, completely. And I love that. Yeah. Oh, it is exactly that. It's like, oh, no, we've covered that.
Yes.
What? No, we've covered it. Yeah, it's done. Oh, okay, yeah. right, okay. We'll,
it's like, we don't want that anymore. I mean,
yeah.
legendarily, you know, they told The Office, like, mock docs are over.
Yeah.
You know, I remember sort of pitching a mock doc thing in like when I was in my early 20s and them going, we've had far too much mock doc stuff. We've had People Like Us or something.
Yeah.
And then The Office comes out and you're sort of like, why do people say that? It's like people going, horror is over.
Yeah. It's like,
people aren't interested in horror anymore. You're like, yeah. what are you talking about? It's just a format.
Yeah.
If you make a bad mock doc, then that is a bad, you know, mock doc. But that doesn't mean the format is dead,
yeah,
you know.
Completely. It's ludicrous,
It's just all this stupid sort of TV speak that happens. But yeah.
So what drew you from, acting club and stuff like that into acting in TV or on stage or comedy? What was your...
So I sort of gave that up when I was about sort of 17 because I was, you know, it was quite academic at school and I was doing my exams and stuff and... kind of that took over, really. Like,
yeah.
my mum and dad were sort of like, oh, you know. My sister had gone to Cambridge, and they were quite keen for me to
pressure.
Go.
Pressure, yeah.
Well, not just keen, they were sort of like, you know, if you don't go, it's not like you'll be the worst child of the two, but you will,
pretty
just slightly
much.
In our mind.
Yeah.
So I sort of wanted to go to art college, really, and I think
right.
in another life I would have done that, and because mm-hmm. I loved art, I loved drawing, that was like my favourite subject really, and I loved making stuff, and I was making costumes and making sets and stuff for my sister who was doing lots of plays, and so I applied to Cambridge and I got in and then I did it, and I kind of knew that it was going to change my life. I knew it was a different world I was going into,
yeah.
and I knew that it was going to be lots of opportunities, but even then I was like, oh no, I'm just going to do sets and costumes. And then this one play that I was doing costumes for, they said, why don't you audition for a part? And I auditioned for a part and I got it. And then I got the acting bug again. And
yeah.
I was suddenly, then I was doing it. And it was almost like all the academic stuff, I didn't care about it anymore. I was just doing the play.
Yeah.
So I was going to like Edinburgh and doing Edinburgh Festival. But at this stage, I was doing like only really kind of serious stuff. And I was working with Paul King, who directs Paddington.
Right, yeah.
And I've sort of had a working relationship with him over many years, but he sort of formed his own theatre company. And he was like, you know, most people are doing, at Cambridge, they're doing like Hamlet and
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
and they're doing, you know, whatever important recognised playwrights there
yeah,
are.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they're doing Footlights.
Yeah.
And I was like, not interested in Footlights at all. Emma Thompson, Stephen Fry, don't... I like Vic and Bob.
Yeah.
What's that got to do with it?
Yeah,
I was sort of like, I had
that.
No interest. It
yeah.
was didn't occur to me to do comedy
yeah.
or be interested. I didn't really know much about the history of Footlights or anything. So I didn't
right.
really, some people go to Cambridge for Footlights.
For purely for that, yeah. 100%.
Because they're like, Dudley Moore, Peter Cook.
Mm-hmm.
And we worship those people and we're going to be that. And I was like, who are they? I hadn't,
who are these
wasn't
guys?
Really
yeah.
educated on that sort of thing.
Can they hit someone with a frying pan?
No,
probably not.
Would they do Man with the Stick?
Yeah.
No.
Don't think so.
Dove for Above. No. But yeah, then I started working with Paul King, and he was like, well, I like Robert Lepage and Theatre de Complicité, which is all the physical theatre stuff.
Right.
And he was sort of encouraging people to go and see this stuff. And he was like, I want to do a theatre company that's like that. And I want it to have, you know, things turning into other things and actors becoming things and music sequences and visual stuff. And I want to do bits that are funny, but bits that are scary. And I'm looking for a group of performers to do that. And so I started working with him, and I was sort of, you know, co-writing this stuff. Like, you come up with a sort of sketch in a way, but, you know, there'd be a horror bit or a comedy bit.
Yeah.
It was all mixing all of that stuff. And we did like 3 shows together at university that then crossed over to going to Edinburgh, and we showed it in London as well. And I was really like, this is what I'm going to do, because it mixes everything that I love. It's got music.
I'd say to have that huge mixture of stuff early on is a massive advantage to kind of have delved into all of it as such, particularly when you'd gone off on the direction of costume or whatever else, to then come back into it and go, right, it can be everything.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be, oh, here's this one thing that it is. It can be all of them.
Well, that's the thing. I think that's, you know, I was never going to be, as I said, like a classical actress or a classical playwright or anything like that. It was sort of like, I'm happy when I'm sewing a costume that I'm going to be wearing and making a bit of music that I'm going to be performing. I like to have control of all of it, which in a way is very like directing. So we were making these weird theatre pieces that were kind of interesting and lots of different emotions to them, and very weird for Cambridge as well. It was seen as being quite out there, what we were doing. And then Richard Ayoade and Matt Holness were doing a comedy show called Garth Marenghi, and I'd not met them, really. I might have met Richard before, but he sort of said to Paul, we need a director and we need an actress. Would Alice do it? And they'd already sort of said, we don't want a comedy actress. We could have had any of these footlights women that they work with. But we want someone who's just an actress. So I was like, oh, all right, I'll be in this show. And it was quite a weird thing that I saw.
Yeah.
And I was like, and then we sort of worked together, and it kind of fitted in how I was going to work with them and how Paul was going to direct it. And it was like a massive learning experience, because it was very disciplined. You know, Richard really is like a surgeon when it comes to like comedy writing. And and so that was really new to me. That was like a learning curve.
And again, the beauty of that project at an early stage is it was so unique. It was completely of its own thing. Mm. So there's not that, can I do this kind of comedy or can I do that? It's like, no, this is its own. It's a brand new kind of thing anyway. I don't know. It's hard to articulate. You're creating a new thing anyway. It's not compared to anything else.
The stage show was kind of like a theatre parody in a way. So there's lots of jokes about bad theatre, but also the ideas behind it were really out there, because it's kind of a horror.
Yeah.
And it's really strange, surreal sort of ideas and costumes and props and odd things. Like, we sort of went into hell at one point, and you're sort of trying to recreate hell with like a puppet on a stick.
Amazing.
And stuff. So it was bringing together everything that Paul and I had done, everything that Richard and Matt have created, with this very intellectual approach and kind of very thorough comedic approach. You know, the way they write jokes is amazing. Their writing ability is really incredible. And but bringing in then me going, I want to play a camel. I mean, literally, that is what I said to them. They were like, yeah, do you want to have a bit where you get to do whatever you want? Like, and me going, yeah, I want to play a camel. And them going, okay.
Right. We weren't expecting that.
But they also introduced me to clowning, which is a thing from Cal McChrystal. So Cal McChrystal had directed a show with Richard Ayoade, and he'd also worked with Paul King. And he is a genius, and he works on the Philip Goliath sort of principles, which is, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen's work with Philip Goliath, lots of comedians. It's this sort of thing of like finding out what is funny about you internally. Yeah. And that thing is like a battery. It's like a comedy battery that will be with you for the rest of your life.
Right.
It's like your energy source.
Yeah.
But it takes a while to find out what that what that clown is. So it's like people say clowns and they think it's about a circus and red noses, but it's not. It's a much more sort of it's much more ancient kind of thing than that. And it's really working out how are you funny. And again, it's this thing of like, when you find out the kernel of who you are,
yeah,
suddenly it all comes into massive clarity and lucidity. You're like, oh, I can stop beating myself up about it. It's just this. You know, and Callum Crystal worked with like Noel and Julian as well, Julian Barrett and Noel Fielding. So he kind of goes, this is the way you work. This is how your interaction is, and it's how it will always be.
Yeah.
And he's sort of like a doctor. He sort of diagnoses you. I love that.
It's fascinating because it's searching for that individual thing that can then be put into a million different roles. Mm. So not about recreating the same thing each time. Essentially, the clown that you find inside you is then going to play Ali G, and then he's going to play Borat, and then he's going to play this and all that. Do you know what I mean? So rather than Sacha Baron Cohen is doing it, it's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because even though those characters are very different, yeah, it's coming from the same source. I think he's kind of a bouffant clown, and that's, I don't know a hell of a lot about it. I'm not an expert, but that's a clown that's very confrontational to the audience, and he puts them in uncomfortable positions.
Yeah.
So if you think about all of the characters that Sacha Baron Cohen does, where he makes people feel discomfort because as Bruno, he invades their personal space, or he asks them to do something, he's trying to take their trousers off, or that's his clown, is he just puts people into those.
There's a fascinating, and I know it's not clown, but there's a fascinating a thing called Slava Snow Show. Have you ever seen? I'm a big fan of that, and the beauty of that is, again, they tour with a group of different clowns who've done exactly that. They've found what kind of clown they are, and some of it is confrontation. They'll be coming into the crowd and shocking you and scaring you, but that's making you laugh. And others are the most passive, not doing anything silly at all, but are just so endearing and engaging. Mm. And I love that kind of finding of it, of not having a stereotype or a specific, even though in that show, all of them except for one have got the exact same face paint and outfits and everything, but it's finding those individuals. So it's giving them the same canvas and going, now your whole character is purely in you. It's not how you look, how you stand. It's purely in you. And then,
well, that's what Richard said to me, and it was all from his clowning perspective. It's like, you know, one day when I was sort of stressing out about what accent I was going to have doing a particular character in the show, and I wanted to be Liverpudlian or something, and I was just like, I just don't know. And Richard just said, look, it's not about what accent you do. It's not about what hat you wear or what shoes you wear or what silly face you face paint you wear or whatever. You're funny. It's not any of those things. You are funny. Yeah. That won't change. So it doesn't matter what accent you do. And that really stuck with me, actually. And it's quite a good metaphor for the whole of your life. It's like, you know, knowing who you are is like the key to happiness or success or something like that. It's kind of like including your weaknesses as well.
Because that is what's going to be with you on every project, in every...
Everything you do, and when
I say project, I mean parenthood, directing, social interaction. That's the one constant, is you.
Yeah, totally. So all of that is like a really useful lesson to learn, especially early on in your career. Because, you know, and then sort of see people struggling, especially I feel quite old now. I am quite old. But I see people struggling at that point, you know, maybe they're 28 or something and they're struggling really with, usually they think it's a battle with the outside world, but really it's a battle with themselves because they haven't kind of got to that point yet. I'm sounding like, I've got it all sorted out. I haven't. I struggle with it myself. And it's like, it's almost like an addiction to narcissism where you start going, why can't I have what I want? And why can't, you know, and things like Facebook can bring it out, you know, and you can slip. And when you find like that happy place, it's like you've got to work at it, you know, completely, to remember, don't be so bloody vain. Well, it's not all about you.
You're like drawn into that vanity and all those things. An example I can draw from the music industry is people complaining. And I've felt it in my career in the past. I go, oh, why aren't Radio 1 playing me?
Mm.
And someone online said, oh, they've blacklisted us, they've done this or that. And then you just kind of have to look and go, well, why do you want them to?
Mm.
Particularly, as stupid as it sounds, if they don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone who doesn't want to play my stuff to play my stuff. That's a weird thing. That's a weird desire to have. You should want the people that do want to hear. Do you know what I mean?
When you stop wanting it, that's when people come to you as well. That's the funny thing. It's like when you let go of something
completely
and stop resisting, that's when it happens.
It's finding the right place and the right home to nurture your particular art and your style of art form and things like that. And we're in a world now where there's a lot of different homes and places for all sorts of creativity because of the internet, because of the open access to so many things.
It's actually a good thing. But yeah, I think to get back to what we were saying about, yes, you know, where it was all coming from. So I kind of did that. And then I got into comedy and I started doing TV comedy.
Yeah.
And I think that was not really... It was fine. I mean, it paid the bills.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really fulfilling what I internally had this desire to do. Yeah. So then I started making short films with a director called Jacqueline Wright. And that was much more fulfilling because suddenly I was like doing all the music and the, that's the thing with film is you can use music and soundscapes and visuals and suddenly it came full circle and it was like what I'm doing now is much more like what I was doing earlier on.
And much more of what you want to do rather than what you've been told that you should want to do because being on TV, that should be the goal.
Yeah.
If you get there and it's not, you're like, oh, this is what I wanted to do all along. That's kind of
well, it was like for ages I was trying to get a sitcom commissioned because I thought that was what you had to do. You know, that was kind of like how you're gonna pay the bill. How are you gonna have a pension when you're old if you haven't had a sitcom? You know, so you're sort of going, it's not enough to have some bit parts in some other people's stuff. I need to kind of have my sitcom. You know, and sort of realise it's just not interested in sitcoms. I don't really like the format that much. I don't really, you know, I'll watch a sitcom, but it's not my favourite thing to watch. Mm-hmm. I'd rather watch a film.
Yeah.
Or I'd rather watch a drama or, you know, stuck into. But yeah, it is this thing of like, you can get very easily distracted into stuff that isn't, you know, what I should have seen that is like, this is just, you know, keeping the wolf from the door. This is not the be all and end all.
Yeah.
The stuff that I'm trying to do is this.
Yeah.
And like, and actually, you know, what I'm doing now is what I think is going to make me really happy and what I should have been doing, possibly. But having said that, I don't think you can rush it.
The beauty of it is you always can look back at these things. And again, me looking back over your IMDb, it looks like a carefully paved plan and it makes perfect a sense. And then, you know, you've led to this point and it's where it's meant to be.
Yeah.
But we need to wrap things up now. And we've not given a shout out to where we are.
We're
at the South London Gallery, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm here all the time. It's got a brilliant cafe.
It's amazing here. I've not been in it in a long while. And it's just been beautifully done up and just, it's in wonderful condition.
Yeah, there's so much to see here. There's like activities for kids and, you know, all sorts going on. I really love it, but, you know, I'm here all the time.
Are you a fan of South London? Or we discussed this. I don't know why I asked that, as if I don't know. But we both discussed how South London is my preferred area of London as well.
I've only ever lived in South London since I came to London.
Yeah.
And I think what you just stay where you first arrived.
Yeah.
And I just feel comfortable here. But it's changing a lot. But I feel like Camberwell, it's sort of not changing in a really bad way that feels really exclusive.
Completely.
You know, I mean, this building is a really community building. It's right 100%. Next to, you know, La Canal, actually, you know, building that burnt down a few years ago. It's been renovated again now, but he's right next door. So, this is a free space.
It feels like in South London, rather than what everyone got angry about in East London, it feels like a lot of the developments, or all of the developments I see, seem to be for the good of the community that are there. Not to get rid of the community that are there or to anything else. It seems they all seem really inclusive and tastefully done and not kind of let's throw a ton of money at this and leave that in shit. It's like, no, well, we're like, this is a perfect example of the South London galleries. As you said, they've put some money into it, but it's for everyone. It's for people in the high rises and people in the nicer houses, like behind the park and stuff like that.
I think there's a real community feeling in Camberwell. I remember, like, during the riots, like, Camberwell didn't get trashed.
No.
I think some of that is because some of the shop owners came outside and protected their shops.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also think there was a feeling of, like, Camberwell is, it's his own space and it's a community and it's sort of like, people are really proud of it, I think.
Yeah.
People have got a real loyalty to Camberwell, the people that live here. because also you are cut off, you don't have like a tube station. Yeah, so once you're here, you're here, and you're in. You know, I really do go and spend money at the local shops, and I do, you know, I buy into the to it as a village in a way, and I think that's a really good thing about it.
That's perfect. Well, let's wrap things up. Where can people
also talk about
get up to date and everything and plug everything? Definitely.
Yeah, because I could easily just waffle on and forget to actually say that the film is out on DVD and Blu-ray.
Excellent.
And as you said, it's available on iTunes.
It's on iTunes Sky, on demand and everything,
And various other things as well.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. And where can people keep up to date with you on social media and stuff like that?
I'm just Alice Lowe on Twitter.
That's it then. That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. I've waffled on loads.
It's great. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Alice Lowe. How lovely is she? I hope you enjoyed that. As we mentioned, Prevenge is still on digital type things, so you can get it on iTunes or on Sky on demand or any of these type places. So go and watch that and enjoy it. And equally, if you fancy The Ghoul, then go and check that out. It comes out on Friday. I've not seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'll be back next week. Well, actually, don't tell anyone, because a lot of people tune out on this outro. But don't tell anyone, but I'm sneaking a bonus podcast in tomorrow. But I'm not going to be posting about it on social media. I'm going to be keeping dead quiet about it. I'm just going to slip it up as a birthday treat for you all. So that's going to be happening tomorrow, but don't tell anyone. But next week, I've got Laurie Penny on, who, again, we had a fantastic chat. She's a great young lady, broadly described as a feminist writer and journalist, self-proclaimed nerd. So, yeah, it was a really good chat, and we got into a lot of really interesting subjects, so I hope you're going to enjoy that one. So for now, I shall leave you all to it. Please don't rate and review. There's so many other podcasts out there that really, you know, want your ratings and reviews. So I've decided, fuck you, go and give them the rating and reviews. I don't even want it, mate. I don't even want it. I don't know what it does. I realised that for 2 years I was saying please rate and review on iTunes because I hear it at the end of all the podcasts I love, and I don't really know what it, like, I've never gone and checked the ratings and reviews on Distraction Pieces. I don't know what they are. We could have terrible, I don't know if they help us in the charts. I mean, maybe you should go and rate and review, maybe ignore me, maybe it'd be a good thing if you went and rated and reviewed, but I don't know, man. It seems a bit much to me. Thanks for tuning in, guys. I'll see you later.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.